I remember being at the National Conference in 1986 on child abuse and neglect. Richard Gelis and Murray Strauss had just released their new study saying violence towards families was down. And someone in the audience, I won't name who she was, said that exact same thing. How can you say the problem is going down? All our funding will go away. Well, that was some years ago. The problem has gone down. Funding has not gone away. And I think it's because, in the essence, people understand that starting and getting parents and children off to a good start remains not just an evidence-based objective, but almost a social justice or a political imperative objective. If we think learning begins at birth with young people, why wouldn't we start providing support to families at that very beginning? And despite Viola's very optimistic picture that in 600 years we'd have a building built and child abuse would be eliminated, I'm not so sure that'll happen. I think we can make measurable progress in reducing it, but we can't get rid of all evil in the world. We can't control everybody's behavior in a free society. So as long as we maintain a focus on the issue, we make measurable, strong progress towards remediating the consequences and preventing its occurrence, I think we're gonna stand in very good shape with any policymaker. And I'd be happy to make the argument to anybody that wants to remove the funding. I'm going to shift our focus just a little bit today and talk not so much about implementing a model. I don't have a particular model I'm going to talk about, but it's about when you have these evidence-based models, how good are you at replicating them and taking them to scale with standard quality? Could I do this too? Okay, great. Yeah, this one too. The main points I want to focus on are three. One, to really underscore the idea that we've made significant progress in improving the quality of the programs that we have to both treat and prevent child abuse. I've been in this field a very long time. Of course, I started when I was 12, as opposed to John. I have seen tremendous progress. And if you have been around here for a while, you really have to admit that we are so much ahead of the game in our understanding of what to do and how to do it with high quality. That said, we face significant challenges in replicating these high-quality programs. And even when the programs are well-specified, well-researched, we know that they can work. We've seen them work. Continuing to replicate them remains a challenge. I'm going to draw on two data sources when I talk today. First is the report, and Mark mentioned it. I was on the committee for the Institute of Medicine's recent study looking at new directions in child abuse and neglect. I'm not going to talk about that whole report, but I wanted to lift up the findings from that report with respect to interventions in terms of what we know. And then secondly, I want to talk about a study I just finished with colleagues at Mathematica, which was a study for the Children's Bureau, which was really looking at the idea of supporting evidence-based home visiting programs. What does it take? What's the infrastructure it takes to really see that these programs are replicated with quality? John's program, Safe Care, was there, implemented by Charles. Sherry's program was there that she talked about yesterday. The PAT enhanced model was one of those studies. And Mark Chaffin's program in Oklahoma was one of those. So let's start with the IOM report. The Institute of Medicine report, which was released this past September, focused on looking at what do we know, what gains have we made in terms of understanding child maltreatment. The report was designed to be a sort of follow-on report to a study that was done in 1993 by the Institute of Medicine that talked about what did we know about child abuse. So our charge, as the slide indicates, was really to build on the literature base. What have we really learned in 20 years? It's a long time. We certainly must have learned something. To look at the research that provides knowledge relevant to programmatic research and policy fields, and then recommend specific research priorities for moving forward. And if we could find anything, cite those things that we shouldn't do any more research on. Well, if you're going to set up a committee like this, you never do it with a group of researchers, because the odds of them finding things that you don't want to keep studying are remote to nil, and that was indeed true. I think we identified many more things we wanted to continue doing than things we wanted to stop. The report talks a lot about the scope of the problem. It talks about the causes of child maltreatment, what do we know, talked about the consequences, talked about child welfare research practice and policy, and what do we know about improvements in that area. We talked specifically about the domain of policy research as opposed to practice research. And then we addressed the issue of infrastructure development for research, not necessarily programs, but what does it take to have a robust environment for research? I'm not going to talk about, obviously, all of those. I'm going to focus on the intervention part. But just by way, I know yesterday one of the comments was made about this balance between decreases in all reports of child abuse, but some kind of increase in child fatalities, the most serious types of child abuse. And indeed, there's been some work that John Leventhal has done at Yale looking at emergency room serious injuries to kids as a result of abuse. He actually found that it's gone up, not down. So some people would say, is that a contradiction? Can you have a reduction in reports and an increase in some serious forms of maltreatment? I don't think it's a contradiction. It makes absolute sense to me because of the way we've pitched our prevention programs and our treatment programs. We're having effects with those people we can reach. But some families that are at the highest risk, the families likely to do the most serious injury to their child, we haven't been very good at reaching them, and I think that's what we're seeing. For families that are being left behind, not only in our economic system, but in our child welfare system, those cases are continuing perhaps to increase, but they're certainly not going down. The committee included a variety of folks. These are the 16 members that we had. It was a very diverse group, unlike the last report, where almost everyone that was on the committee actually knew something about child maltreatment because they had worked in the field. This was a group that came from all disciplines and maybe had touched on the issue only tangentially. We liked that. I think everyone on the committee felt that it pushed our notions a little further. We had to talk about our expectations and our assumptions with a little more detail than we had before. So all in all, we were pleased with the report and we're pleased with the recommendations. Let me talk about the intervention findings. It was clear, as the committee debated the issue, that we certainly lacked perfect knowledge with respect to scope, causes, and consequences. But you know, that didn't stop us from coming up, and it has not stopped the field from developing a variety of treatment and intervention programs. We felt that there had been significant advances. In terms of prevention services, I think it's very clear this is a field that focuses much more heavily on early intervention than it ever did before. I like to think of thinking of the prevention continuum as being kind of a horizontal imagery where everything was equally weighted. It didn't matter what you tried to do, every idea was just as good as anybody else's idea when I started in this field. Over the past 20 years, that has really shifted to almost a vertical imagery where the emphasis has really become starting at the foundation. If you want kids and parents off to a good start, you start working with families when women are pregnant or certainly at the time that baby comes home from the hospital. Home visitation has risen to near star status in the minds of many. It's the go-to intervention, not just for the Obama administration, but for a lot of people that really say, and you've heard about a lot of these evidence-based programs, they're delivered in the home. There's a lot of saliency to go to the home, to go to families where they are. It eliminates a lot of the barriers to intervention that we know families face. Just as a sideline, you know, home visitation, the word. Well, did you ever look it up in the dictionary, what home visitation means?
For a funeral?
No, it's actually death, angel of death, destruction. The wrath of God will fall on you because you've done something wrong. It's no wonder people don't like home visitation. I like to think of home visiting, it's a little more of an action word. But we were somewhat shocked when we actually went to the dictionary. In addition to that, I think in prevention, we feel we've done some really good work on public engagement and awareness efforts. Parenting education programs that are really providing parents very concrete, specific information on how they can best care for their kids. And then a lot of work in terms of what I call practice reform, changes in how doctors interact with their parents, how teachers interact with their students, and the like. In terms of the treatment success, those on the committee really felt that we have shifted in terms of treatment programs for maltreatment to a platform that really does look at trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy that worries less about how the child got to experience these conditions, but more on the reality they're currently facing. So it really brings a nice marriage of folks that are looking at a lot of forms of trauma, finally coming together and working collectively on resolving the issue. Also, while treatment programs may have focused on either the child or the parent, today, as you heard earlier today, these programs are working together. You're trying to change the parents and improve child behavior at the same time, so there's real synergy going on now in the family unit. In contrast to what the committee had seen in 1993, at this point, the committee felt that policymakers and practitioners had a much stronger pool of promising programs to work on in terms of building their response at the local level to maltreatment. So when it came time to talk about the future in intervention, the committee did not do what everyone expected us to do, which was to write a treatment section and a prevention section. And the reason we did that is that we combined it because we felt that the challenges intervention programs are facing are exactly the same whether you're working at the prevention end of the continuum or the treatment end of the continuum. And we wanted to use this as a way of drawing the field together, if you will, because if you're in prevention, you're spending a lot of time at early childhood conferences. If you're at treatment, you're spending a lot of time at trauma conferences. We don't come together as a field as much as we did when the field first started. We think the notion of thinking about how best to implement and improve programs is really can be a unifying theme that can actually strengthen the field. So we did think that there were a number of gaps in how we do our work. We certainly need to have a greater understanding of the underlying reasons why some families or individuals benefit from our current efforts and some families don't. How evidence-based practices and interventions are implemented and replicated and sustained. And then really what service attributes are most essential in achieving desired impacts and for whom. We specifically wanted to look at the dissemination and implementation issues by thinking about what does it mean to implement in communities with fidelity. Indeed, I think the whole notion of what does fidelity mean is a question that we're struggling with, as my second part of the presentation will talk about. The whole idea of taking interventions to scale, how do you make them common, readily available, and easily accessible to families? And then sustaining programs over time with quality remains a major challenge. In terms of infrastructure development, programs, like individuals, need a receptive context in which to grow. I like to think of this as if you imagine you have a plant that you've grown in the hothouse, and your plant is a beautiful plant, and you want to put it in your garden. So you plant it in your garden in soil that's not very good, where the sun doesn't shine. Then you don't water the plant, and the plant dies. And you say to yourself, silly plant, you should have been able to overcome any adversity you faced. That's what we do to evidence-based programs, quite honestly. We put them in a context organizationally, contextually, that makes it very difficult for them to do their best work. So if we want programs to thrive, we need to begin to look more specifically at what kind of workforce are we providing, what's the pipeline for workers to staff these programs, what kind of data management system do we have, information that's time sensitive, quality improvements and systems that programs can use to constantly know how they're doing and what they need to do differently, and then to work more intentionally on fostering system integration and collective impact. Any program is only going to be as good as all the programs that are surrounding it, because we do depend on each other, we do use each other. Every program that makes a referral is saying to themselves, I've taken this family as far as I can go, I need someone else to take that family further. And if that program can't do the job at the quality level you're used to, your gains are going to be minimized. And so the sense of really making us understand that we're all in this together, it's not this competition. Your program's going to find it very hard to succeed if those programs around you are not doing their job. So that's the IOM report in a nutshell, just around intervention. But it does a nice setup to think about the second study we did, which was this supporting evidence-based practice for home visitation. This was a program that was funded by the Children's Bureau and was, in truth, supposed to be the precursor to the maternal infant child health program. I call it McVie, somebody calls it Mitchvie, but I think that's a pastry, that just can't happen. And the program was embedded in the Affordable Care Act because it was a marvelous opportunity. As folks in Congress said, if you have a large program, how do you get it through a reluctant Congress? You put it in a larger program, and no one will ever know that it's there. In truth, very few people knew it was there. We got some pushback from some of the most conservative elements, but in truth, $1.5 billion was allocated to states over a five-year period to implement home visitation programs, but more importantly, to create an infrastructure and a set of collaborative agency linkages that could support these programs going forward. We had thought that we would have the data on this study done before we would actually get the home visitation program implemented. It didn't work that way because it was this one moment in opportunity. We took it. We did it, and so we, if though anybody here that's involved with the state, local state McPhee implementation, you know, there's a few bumps in the road, but it's getting better. We're making improvements. But the lessons from this study, I think, really inform and serve as a precursor for some of the things we're going to have to deal with eventually if we do want to take any intervention to scale, be it home visiting for support services for newborns and their parents, or any of the other wonderful models you heard about today. The study was funded by the Children's Bureau with additional support from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation and the Casey Family Program, particularly around our cost component. It was done jointly between Chapin Hall and Mathematica. Myself and Kim Bowler from Mathematica were the co-PIs. It involved 17 what we call subcontractors, which is a other no long story, which we won't go into. So there were 17 agencies in 15 different states. And we engaged the national models of the national home visitation models that were part of our sample. And these are the ones that are in that sample. We have some of the subcontractors elected to implement Nurse Family Partnership. Some picked Healthy Families America, Parents as Teachers. Safe Care in One program did a single component of Triple P, which was their clinical intervention for high need families. Some of the subcontractors implemented multiple models, which is why these numbers add up to more than 17. They're all well known. They all have national service offices. We worked diligently with all of them to make sure that as we moved forward with the research, we were doing it in ways that could support the further development and understanding of these models, as well as support the mission of the overall initiative. You can see the programs vary in who they target. Nurse Family Partnership is the most specific, targeting first-time pregnant women that have accessed prenatal care under 28 weeks gestation. Healthy Families America does do a screening, but they look at both pregnant women and new parents that are seen to be at elevated risk for child maltreatment. Parents as Teachers has the most open program, often considered a universal intake program, if you will, working with parents birth through age 5. Safe Care works through birth to age 5 for purposes of this study, although I know you can go older, and then Triple P. The program, the evaluation itself, had 4 specific components. Fidelity, which is what I'm going to speak about today, and that question was simply, were home visiting programs implemented and delivered with fidelity? We did a cost component, how much do these programs cost, which I'm not going to talk about, but if folks have questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Then we looked at this infrastructure building. How did they bring people together? Did they form partnerships? Did they share information? What exactly occurred? And then how critical was this infrastructure or partnerships related to the goals of the initiative, which was really increasing scale up, improving fidelity, and maintaining sustainability? I'm going to talk about the fidelity part because I think it marries nicely with what we've been talking about here, in that I think the notion has been that if you have evidence-based programs, somehow they're going to be easier to replicate than the kind of less than stellar practice we've done in the past. That was the question we asked, and that's what we wanted to focus on. So when we thought about our fidelity framework, we developed a common framework, something that would work across all the models. Not that every benchmark we identified would be the same for each model, because sometimes it was an absolute benchmark, sometimes it was program reads a percent of whatever the standard was that was set by the model. We wanted to minimize data burden on the home visitors in the program, because we got our data from the programs themselves in some cases. In other cases, we got it from the National Service Office at NFP. But we wanted to build on what was there. So a lot of our definition of terms came from existing data collection methods the programs were using. We wanted to look at capture implementation, but also wanted to make sure we understood the nature of the families that were receiving these services, because we believed, in part, these programs have different catchment areas, they have different outreach, different eligibility criteria. It's possible the programs would look different from each other. Our framework had 2 components, what I've called structural fidelity. Some people call that implementation fidelity. And that's really like if you think of the house, it's the structural parts of the house, not the I-beam, but even more than the I-beam, the kinds of little things you put in a house when you build it, right? You have little beams or something like that. And those are things that are easily measured. Often this is what funders think of when they think of fidelity. They look at, did you hire the right staff? Did you engage the right target population? Are you achieving recommended dosage and duration? Are your caseloads up to par? But then we also were interested in considering questions of what we call dynamic fidelity. It's really the nature in which the services are provided. Are you doing it with the spirit and intent of the original model developer? And are you covering the content that people want? And are you embracing the values that the program ascribes to? Our final framework had seven structural domains supported by 21 indicators and four dynamic domains supported by 14 indicators. And again, the specific framework is available at the, I'll give you the information at the end. Okay. All right. A sample size, this is what we have. You can see we had a total of implementing agencies that were involved in this. The samples are quite large, close to 5,000 participants, 294 providers, and almost 90,000 home visits. So this is a pretty substantial data collection. We collected data for a total of 32 months. And I've talked where the data came from. So what I want to, because NFP is a large part of this, on some indicators I'm going to break it down by model so you can see what we're talking about. Let me talk first about the areas in which I would say the fidelity was quite high. These programs hired BA level home visitors. I know there's a lot of talk about these are paraprofessionals in these programs. Even Healthy Families America had a very high percentage, over 70% of their home visitors had a BA. NFP, of course, requires having a nursing degree. But these are people that are carrying some degree of training, not the level that certainly you see in a mental health agency, but they're individuals that have some degree of educational accomplishment. Staff get the training they need. People aren't going out into the field without having the training they need. They're getting referrals that match their standards, so this isn't a case of people sending them families they don't know why they're doing it or why. They're not getting inappropriate referrals. About 82% of the home visits were completed, planned home visits were completed. So we have this notion of a lot of people not showing up for visits, missing visits. In this case, this doesn't mean that visits weren't rescheduled, but essentially when the visit was planned, the visit was delivered. And then for the most part, people did cover the content that was planned. So where were we concerned? This talks about, first off, with caseloads. If you look at the first, this was over 32 months, and this means that consistently the workers, the home visitors, take the top line, had the caseload they were supposed to have based on the model standard. It's not surprising that it's very low. I mean, nobody keeps the exact caseload they're supposed to have every month during a data collection period. When we started this study, our notion had been that the big problem would be people were over. You had more families than you were working with. That turned out not to be the case. Quite honestly, it was just the opposite. These programs were running with significantly lower caseloads than they could have carried based on the model standard. There's a lot of reasons for this. Some people said, oh, it's tenure. These were new programs. In truth, we controlled for tenure, and it wasn't a case. Some of these programs were not new. They were expanded to respond to this initiative, but they were not new. Some people said the caseloads are just too large. You know, this is an intentional decision by workers to work with fewer families than they're allowed to work with. And they've made that decision, and that's the decision they've made. In other cases, maybe they're not getting the referrals at the rate in which they thought they would get. When we did this initiative, remember, it's at a time when McVie is getting up and going. There's a lot of new home visiting programs hitting the streets about the same time. It's possible that for some brief period of time, there was some saturation in the existing referral sources. Again, we don't know that for sure. This is the retention and dosage, and this is what I sort of would like you to leave. I'm going to leave you with this, just a few other comments. These were families and how long they were retained in the service. Now, keep in mind, the first three programs here are relatively long-term programs. They say they're going to provide services for 2 to 3 years. The second two columns are short-term programs. They're in and out, 18 sessions, 16 sessions, and the like. As you can see, at 3 months, most of these people are retained 3 months. A good number are retained 6 months. Now, the 12 months for the short-term programs, you have to keep in mind they in some ways shouldn't have been there 12 months. So that's it. But the long-term programs, we're keeping people even a year, in some cases, just a little over half of what they thought they would keep. So you can bring someone to a program for 2 years and say you're going to keep them for 2 to 3 years, But they do, these are voluntary programs, and people have every right, every ability to walk away unless they're feeling they're getting a good exchange. In other work we've done, we think of this prevention, this engagement issue as really the sort of a benefit cost analysis that individuals do in their head. And when they feel they're not getting enough to compensate them for their time and their effort, they'll walk away. And this would suggest that a good number did that. In dosage, we're just looking at the three long-term programs. And this is what was somewhat surprising to us. When we looked at the maximum dosage, the model said that they say this is what they give in 12 months. You can see a very small percentage of these families got that dosage. Slightly larger got 80%, and then a somewhat larger dosage group got 60%. We didn't have outcome data. I don't know if this is good or bad. And it is clear that is perhaps you don't need to do every single thing. I mean, you don't even have to take every pill in your pill box, and they basically...
Except your antibiotics.
Except your antibiotics. But people are even, you know, they're basically, those dosages are set, assuming not everybody will do it exactly the right way. So it's possible that that's what's going on here. But it's also very possible that at some point, the dosage falls below what's reasonable for people to get. And that's the question I think we really have to ask ourselves. We had some, you know, some predictable issues in terms of who stayed and who didn't. I will tell you the families that were most significantly challenged from a socioeconomic standpoint, if you can keep them 6 months in these long-term programs, they're not more difficult to provide services to or dosage to. They actually do quite well as folks that don't present the same level of risk. Implications for our work. Wide variability in model. This is not a model problem. This is not some models did it well and some models did it poorly. In truth, all the models face the same challenge. The findings, I think, do raise questions about what's an appropriate dosage and service delivery mechanism. I think it identifies some things that models have in common, but some things that models need to be unique. And most importantly for me, it really underscores that just investing in evidence-based programs, if that's the policy decision you make and you don't do anything else after that, in terms of quality improvement systems, in terms of regular training, in terms of good observation, there is no way that even evidence-based programs can achieve the outcomes that we desire. At the end of the slide, and I know they're going to make these available, this is how you can get all the information, both for the IOM report and the EVHB study. Thanks.